So tonight we're going to continue our discussion of the church, and I don't quite know how far we're going to get, but we're going to talk about those that have been given to us by God and the sphere of influence where those that were given function.
Are we recording?
Oh, yes, thank you. And
recording in progress.
If it wasn't for somebody helping me out, I'd lose my brain.
Welcome to the club.
So let's begin by looking at Ephesians 4. That'll be kind of the text for our discussion of this idea. And then there's a different listing of those that we've been given by God in 1 Corinthians 12. Now, the list in 1 Corinthians 12 is a little bit longer than the list here in Ephesians 4. But let's read these two passages, and we'll kind of combine them into one to get our overall list. But we'll really work with Ephesians 4. So can I get someone to read Ephesians 4, 11 through 13?
And he gave some as apostles, and some as prophets, and some as evangelists, and some as pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints for the work of service, to the building up of the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a mature man, to the measure of the stature, which belongs to the fullness of Christ.
Okay. Thank you, Doc. And that's not an easy passage to read. Thank you for your skill at reading that. So when we talk about these people that God has given, my conclusion is that these are people that are given for the body of Christ. And my conclusion here is, in Ephesians, is that when the apostle is using that word here in Ephesians, he's talking about the church. And we'll see that. We see it so often when we look at the first chapter. That's kind of the way he begins this chapter. So we have apostles, prophets, evangelists, and pastors and teachers. So that's the four that we're going to look at beginning tonight. First, can somebody read 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 28?
And God. And, go ahead.
Go ahead.
That's all right.
And God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healing, helps, administrations, various kinds of tongues.
Okay. So this listing in 1 Corinthians 12, in my mind, seems to be kind of a combination. In part of that, he's talking about the people, and in part of it, he's talking about the specific manifestation of the Spirit that a particular individual has. So, as you can see, the list in 1 Corinthians 12 is much longer than the list here in Ephesians 4. Now, anytime we talk about the people that work in the church, the place that we have to begin is with Jesus. Jesus is not physically here, but nevertheless continues to operate within the church doing a specific function. Can someone read Ephesians 1, 20 through 23?
Which he brought about in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at the right hand, his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. And he put all things in subjection under his feet and gave him as head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all.
Okay. Now, in my way of thinking, it's important to understand that Jesus is the head over the church. And that's interesting idea there. Church is in the singular. It's not saying that Jesus is the head over churches, but gave him to be head over the church. And so that just kind of reinforces the idea that that we can talk about the church as existing and composed of all of the people everywhere who are in Christ. So it's kind of beyond the notion of just a simple ecclesia. It's still a group that's called together for a purpose. But usually when we think about a group that's called together for a purpose, we think about a group that's called together physically. And this is, I think, one of those instances where the apostle is using the term in a much broader sense to talk about the ecclesia that's comprised of all of the people that are belonging to Jesus. So anytime we talk about those people that have an important role in the church, this is where we have to begin, at least to my way of thinking. Now, that's not something that the Apostle Paul included in either the list to the Corinthians or to the Ephesians. As I struggled to try to understand that, I think the reason that he didn't include it in the letter to the Ephesians is that he's already included it in Ephesians 1, and you have to read this letter as a whole. So if he includes it in Ephesians 1, he doesn't have to re-mention that position in Ephesians 4. And I think Ephesians 4 is a discussion of those people that we are going to see in the church if we live in the first century. So we'll talk about that a little bit more as we continue. So, other thoughts about Jesus as the head of the church? Okay. Then he mentions apostles. Now, some folks would argue that Jesus gave apostles and that kind of person must exist in the church at all times. And the people that would generally tend to argue that, that you would probably be most familiar with, is the Mormon church. They would argue that you have to have apostles because Jesus gave apostles. My response is that we're built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone.
Is that the right verse?
So I don't need a living apostle today. I don't need someone to replace the apostle Paul or John or Peter, because they have written and we have their word that still guides us. And we don't need a living apostle any more than we need a living Christ or a living head of the church. Remember, he says, we're built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. So if you would make the argument that we need living apostles, then it seems to me that in essence, you're making the argument that we still need a living Messiah. We still need a living Lord. Comment.
We don't have anybody that would qualify as an apostle today. There's not anybody qualified for that.
Okay.
An apostle, because none of us have seen Jesus. That doesn't mean that we need apostles. They were, in the beginning, the ones that were teaching about Christ.
So you would...
Along with the prophets.
You would refer to 1 Corinthians 8, where the apostle Paul says, last of all, he was seen of me as one born out of due time. And I know that go ahead.
I was just going to say they had to have seen Jesus and been with him, the apostles, and Paul was born out of due season. And he saw Christ too, because he told him what to do, the light. So, but they could testify what they saw, and we couldn't do that today.
Okay.
And the prophets, they all were prophesying about Jesus and teaching what Jesus told them to.
Right. Now understand.
That's just my thought.
That it's a good thought, but understand that the Mormons think that their apostles have seen Jesus too. Just like the apostle Paul said that he saw Jesus.
Not in the flesh.
Well, I disagree with them.
Well,
and part of the reason...
Yeah, but that's what they think.
Yeah, part of the reason is that the Apostle Paul says that he was last of all. And that phrase has to mean something. So I would argue that the people that they want to be apostles have not seen God. And Jimmy correctly and rightly refers to 1 Corinthians 8. And at the end of Acts 1, after Judas had hanged himself and the apostles sought to replace him, choose another to fill what they called his bishopric or his office, one of the qualifications that they mentioned was that this person had accompanied with Jesus from the beginning. So they had two that they chose. They cast lots, and then Matthias was numbered with the 12. So you're absolutely correct. But what was their place in the church? What role did the apostles have? We know the role that Jesus has. He's the head. What role did the apostles have? So let's look at a number of passages, and I think it will help to clarify the role that the apostles had relative to the church. So let's read these four passages, and we'll just, somebody read the first one, somebody read the next one, and we'll just keep going that way.
Apart from such external things, there is a daily pressure on me of concern for all the churches.
Okay. Now, who was making that statement?
Wasn't it Paul?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And Paul, of course, we know was an apostle. So he talks about, well, in 2 Corinthians 11, he talks about everything that had happened to him. I've been stoned, left for dead, and just beat up. And then he says, and on top of all of that, there's the care of all the churches. How about Acts 18, verse 23?
After he had spent some time there, he departed and went over the region of Galatia and Phrygia in order of strengthening all the disciples.
Okay, and again, who is this?
Paul.
Yes. So Paul is going throughout a region where he'd already preached and strengthening all the churches. 1 Corinthians 11, 34.
And if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, so that you will not come together for judgment. The remaining matters I will arrange when I come.
And again, this is, who is this?
Paul.
This is Paul. So he's giving them some information in the letter about the way that they ought to proceed when they participate in the Lord's Supper. And he also says, when I come there, I'll give you some more information. Or the rest I will set in order. And that phrase, set in order, that's a really interesting kind of phrase. That's to order everything according to the plan. So I've always been impressed when I go to the mall and I walk past one of these real trendy shops like Hollister or one of those shops that sort of specializes in the clothes for the young people or the hip people. And have you ever noticed that when they put out the mannequins and they arrange things on the shelves, they do it according to a specific plan? It even specifies how they're going to hang their pants up so that they look really cool when they hang it by that back belt loop and it kind of drapes down, and it's everything's a plan. So they're putting it in order. They're not the people that developed the plan, but they're putting it in order. So I see the Apostle Paul functioning in that same way. He's putting things in order. He's not the person that devised the plan, but he is helping them to get things going in the right way. 1 Corinthians 16 at verse 1.
Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye.
So who is it that has given orders to the churches at Galatia?
That would be Paul.
Okay. So I think you pretty clearly have Paul, who's functioning in the role of an apostle. And his sphere of influence, if you will, is beyond any single local ecclesia. He's giving the same instruction no matter where he is. Now, he did recognize that sometimes different places have different customs. And he says that we follow those customs. And I was that's a thought that occurred to me just now, and I apologize that I didn't think of that earlier. It occurred to me because I was looking at 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter. 1 Corinthians 11, beginning at, verse 13, he says, judging yourselves, is it comely that a woman pray unto God uncovered? Doth not even nature itself, and that's your customs, teach you that if a man have long hair, it's a shame to him. If a woman have long hair, it's a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. But if any man seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. So sometimes you have local customs that are reflected in churches that are not going to be the same in every church, in every locality. Go ahead. Someone had a question? And I think it also has to be said that those local customs evolve. It wasn't too many years ago that when a man and a woman were married in our country, the woman took the husband's last name and she kept her old maiden name. She kept her maiden name, the one that she had ever since birth. She kept that one and usually turned it into her maiden name. Most people did it the way my mom did it. She was Ruth Hayes Coward. That was her her number, but that was her name. That was her given name as a little girl. When she got married, she changed her name to Ruth Coward Cruz, but it wasn't a hyphenated last name. And the custom is kind of changing in this country. People, a lot of women who are in professional positions, when they marry, they don't change their last name, because they've already built a reputation on the basis of their first name. And when I was teaching at EWU, there were a lot of my students who enrolled in graduate school before they were married. They got married while they were in graduate school, but because of making sure that they kept all of their records intact, they didn't change their name because it would increase the probability that they would lose some records. So customs change over time. Some things are inviolate. They never change. But some things do change. And that's why the apostle would say, here at the end of verse 16 in 1 Corinthians 11, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. So there are some things that have to be set in order, and the apostles were involved in that. And there are some things that they had to remind us are not a matter of things that have to be set in order. Can you think of other illustrations of things that are customs that can change? And the way that they're manifested in the church can change.
Well, I guess just in my lifetime, when I was young, women would never wear pants to church. You would never wear slacks to church. Men who served at the Lord's table at the congregations where I was associated always had to have on a tie or a jacket. It's definitely changed over the years. That's not something that the Lord has dictated in his church. It's something that is related culturally. So now it's, you know, we don't think anything of women wearing pants to church to worship, or men not wearing ties and or suits. I mean, goodness, I don't know what age I was, but when I started noticing that men weren't wearing suits, entire suits to church to worship. So things just change like that, that are cultural. There are other parts of the country where they dress very differently than we do here in the Pacific Northwest. I don't think that is dictated by God. But I think the concept of doing things decently and in order, and, you know, there are a lot of concepts that are related to that. But anyway, that's just something that I think might be cultural.
That's so true, Kim. It was the hardest thing for me this morning to wear what I wore. They were jeans. And the reason was because my slacks are too large now. And it really bothered me. And I thought, well, they're clean, you know, and I doubt if anyone noticed or anything, but at the same time, it was hard. And that was, that was why, thinking about what you just said.
Right. Right. And like you said, nobody noticed, but you did. But that's not what was important. I think if that was really the important and critical thing, God would have set that as one of those things that he set in order. And I don't read in the scriptures that that's something that he set in order.
When I was growing up, the men always shook hands when they came to the church building and called each other brother. And they knelt very often for prayers.
Yes, I remember that as well.
Yep, I do. I do too. And you would, if you were, I guess I finally got old enough that now I could refer to somebody by their first name. But I remember when I was a kid, I referred to an older man by his first name. And when I woke up, I realized that was not something that I was supposed to do around my father.
I still have a hard time referring to some people that I grew up calling brother and sister. That's still what, and they were older than me. Of course, no one's older than me now, but that was back then. And I still have a difficult time with that. They're still brother and sister so-and-so to me.
Now you're old enough, you can call Moses by his first name, huh?
Exactly.
Well, you know, I think an important function of the apostles was to help us learn to differentiate between that which was custom and that which needed to be set in order because it had been given by God.
Dean?
Yes.
One other thing, that they were all witnesses, which I think Jimmy sort of touched on when she was talking about the current ones couldn't be witnesses, but they were witnesses and they had the Spirit, the Holy Spirit with them and could do miracles.
Well, that's true. That's true. And that gets to kind of the blending of those ideas in the Corinthian list that we saw already. The Ephesians list seems to be directed more to different people or different functions. The Corinthian list is kind of a blend, and that's to be expected because that's really the context there in the 12th chapter. But good point. Okay. Then you have next in the listing here in Ephesians 4, you have the prophets. Now we know what the word prophet means. It's just a spokesman. In this case, I think it's someone who is a spokesman for God. You could have prophets that were spokesmen for other people, just like Aaron was a spokesman for Moses. So he's called Moses' prophet. Now everything gets back to God ultimately, but churches could have prophets that were their spokespeople. But I think in this context, in Ephesians 4, this is referring to something that God has done. He's given some people to be prophets. So rather than reading 1 Corinthians, the 14th chapter, in its entirety, and it would be profitable to read 1 Corinthians 14 just as a in its entirety. But in terms of the prophet and the work that the prophet did, I kind of picked out some of the passages here in 1 Corinthians 14 where he talks about the prophet. And we'll get a little bit more into who that might be. But let's just read these little snippets. And I hate doing that because it runs the risk of taking things out of context. But I would invite you to read the entirety of 1 Corinthians 14 tonight. Let me read verse 1. I'll just go through and pick these little snippets of 1 Corinthians 14. He says, follow after charity, desire spiritual gifts, but rather that you may prophesy. So in that case, I think he's talking about a specific manifestation of the Spirit and not necessarily a person who is given as a prophet. Verse 6, he says, now, brethren, if I come to you speaking with tongues, what shall I profit you except I speak to you either by revelation or by knowledge or by prophesying or by doctrine? So my conclusion is that the notion of prophesying was for the benefit of the churches. And you see that, I think, consistently throughout this passage here in 1 Corinthians 14. In verse 22, he says, wherefore, tongues are for a sign, not to them that believe, but to them that believe not. Prophesying serves not for them that believe not, but for them which believe. So this prophesying, this sense in which some people were given, was for the benefit of the church, not necessarily for the benefit of those people that were outside. Now, every time I talk about prophesying, I always remind people that we have this notion that prophesying is telling the future. That's not the root meaning of the word prophesy. Some prophets did tell the future, but the root meaning of prophesy is to just be a spokesman, to reveal some things. Verse 24, if all prophesy, and there come in one that believes not, or one that's unlearned, he's convinced of all, he's judged of all. Verse 31, he says, you may all prophesy one by one, that all may learn and all may be comforted. So there were within this Corinthian church, apparently, multiple prophets. And he says, prophesy one by one so that everybody learns. And the way that they did that is that their approach to taking turns, if you will, is if you were a prophet and you were speaking and another prophet began speaking, then the first speaker relinquished the floor and sat down, and the second person would continue speaking. Now, we don't do things typically that way in our culture. What we do is if someone is speaking and you have something to say, you wait your turn. So the Corinthian model that we've kind of adopted because of Zoom and how difficult it is to figure out who has something to say comes from this model that they used. Now, there were other churches, other places where the apostles or Jesus himself came into a situation and he waited his turn. And when somebody else finished speaking, then Jesus began speaking, or the apostles began speaking. That was a matter of custom. I'm not so much concerned with the custom of how they did things as I am just the identity that there were prophets in these churches. And there may have been more than one prophet in a particular place. Verse 39, he says, wherefore, brethren, covet to prophesy and forbid not to speak with tongues, but then mentions in verse 40, let all things be done decently and in order. So there were these prophets who made things known. And I think that we could be pretty clear that these prophets were speaking on behalf of God. They weren't just taking it upon themselves to speak something. This, I think, was a spiritual gift that was given by the Spirit for a specific purpose. And we've talked about the Spirit and what the Spirit did and how important it was for the information to get out there, because they didn't have Bibles that they could go read. We have all of the information that the Spirit wanted to give, and it's gathered for us in one place in our Bibles, but they didn't have that back then. In fact, much of the New Testament hadn't been written when you had these prophets in churches. Now that the New Testament has been written, we don't need to have a living prophet any more than we need to have a living apostle or a living Messiah. We're built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. So we have the work that they did, and it continues to guide us in the same way that it guided them. Now, when they were being guided by it, they were hearing it firsthand. We're not hearing it firsthand, but that doesn't change the nature of the thing that we're hearing. It only changes the method of delivery. And it's important to note, I think, that these prophets in churches may have been women. In fact, they are on a number of different occasions referred to as being prophets. Acts, the second chapter, passage that we're very familiar with, is a reference to what was going to happen, to what Joel had said was going to happen in the last days. Joel said, your sons and your daughters will prophesy. And you have the Apostle Peter standing up in Acts 2, and he says, hey, what you're seeing is what Joel talked about. We're not drunk. We're filled with the Spirit. This is what you're seeing. It's what Joel talked about. This is going to characterize the last days. So the sons and daughters would prophesy. Acts, the 21st chapter. And verse 9 is a statement specifically about what was happening with the Apostle Paul. He's traveling around. In verse 8, it says, the next day, we that were of Paul's company departed. We came to Caesarea. We entered into the house of Philip, the evangelist, which was one of the seven, and we abode with him. The same man had four daughters, virgins, who did prophesy. So as Philip had been given a position or a work to do in the church and had been empowered to do that work by the Spirit, I think you see the same thing with women in the early church. Now, does that continue? I don't think it does, any more than the apostles continue. But I do think that you had women in the church who were prophets. So questions, comments about prophets. Okay, the next one I want to discuss is the evangelists or the teachers. And I'm pretty well convinced that we're not going to be able to get through this in the 5 minutes that we have left. So I would like to take a break here and come back next week and continue with the evangelists and the teachers, and then also talk about the elders and the pastors. So let's take a break here. It is a good place to break, because up until this point, we've talked about Jesus, we've talked about the apostles, the prophets. We're built on the work that they did. That's not the same as saying that they still continue to populate churches, that they still continue to walk on the earth. And now we're going to shift gears a little bit And we get to evangelists and teachers and those that are elders or pastors. Now, those are people that are still here. So this is a good place to make a break in our discussion of the people that were given us by God in churches. So we'll take up with this discussion next week. Again, let me open it up. Does anyone have thoughts about what we've been looking at thus far?
Time she was down a few while ago.
So the prophets, there's a big old mega church in Junction City, and they had a big seminar because a prophet showed up. My brother spent 3 days with him, and I'm pretty convinced that my brother believes he's a prophet. And I don't know, how would you respond to something like that? I don't believe that there are prophets anymore. There's no reason to have prophets anymore. They've already fulfilled their purpose. But there are a lot of people out there who think they are.
Yeah, well, remember when Paul wrote to the church in Corinth, there was this problem with people that claimed to be apostles or claimed to be prophets. And I think the most important test is the one that Paul used. He said, if anyone thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge that the things that I write unto you are are inspired by God. And let me get that reference for you. Boy, there was a time when I could have done that without looking, but if anyone.
Well, I know he's writing a paper about numbers. He's so into numbers and dreams, and it's kind of frightening, really.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Come on, somebody help me out. If anyone thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge.
If it's in like 1 Corinthians, I intend to read that tonight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would come across that.
Yeah, that's 1 Corinthians.
Well, I'm going to read 1 Corinthians tonight, so I'm sure I will come across that.
Yeah.
He was talking to my mom this weekend, telling her about how he talks to God, and God's talking back and telling him how to do this number thing that he's writing a paper on. He holds seminars in Vancouver, sold out seminars on interpreting people's dreams. So it's scary.
Yeah, it really is scary. And they are convinced that they are a prophet in the sense in which those prophets existed in the early church.
Oh, I think he is. And I don't think that I'll ever change his mind.
Yeah, unfortunately, you may be right. It's very different to change someone's mind when, especially when they're convinced that they have a word from God. And anything that you could add to that discussion that would contradict them is de facto to be rejected.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very difficult.
Well, I will definitely be reading 1 Corinthians tonight.
Yeah.
And at least you're willing to try.
There is a way to identify a prophet.
At least you're willing to try, and there's nothing impossible.
True, it's not a prophet.
Yeah.
1 Corinthians 14:37.
That's what I thought. 1 Corinthians 14. Thank you, Faye.
There's also in the Old Testament, if anyone thinks it calls himself a prophet, then there's the test.
Right. And what was the test in the Old Testament?
Do the things happen that this person is saying are going to happen? And if they don't, then he's not a prophet. But I have to look to see where that is. I don't know where that is.
I believe that's in Jeremiah, but I'm not sure.
Jeremiah?
You find out whether or not the things that he prophesies comes true.
Yeah, I don't listen to him much. And he doesn't talk to me because I argue with him.
Yeah.
Yes. Is the test of being bitten by a serpent and living, is that the test for an apostle and not for a prophet?
My recollection is that that was something that Jesus said to the apostles when he sent them out on the limited commission. That's just my recollection. You caught me off guard with that, but.
We'll be praying for you, Jane.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Keep up the good work, Jane. Don't give up.
Okay. Thank you, Lee.
It is very difficult. That, you know, the second kind of approach to that is to say that no lie is of the truth. The truth is internally consistent. And if that's the case, then you can't say something that clearly contradicts something that's biblical. And I guess maybe the easiest place to go to show that is Galatians 1, 8 and 9, though he says, I marvel that you're so soon removed from him that called you unto the grace of God unto another gospel, which is not another. And the key there is the contradiction. And we can go through some pretty amazing calisthenics to avoid acknowledging that there's a contradiction. But that's what we have to understand, what we have to look at. As you'll see next week when we talk about elders and the pastors, a lot of this comes from conclusions that they had to reach during the Restoration Movement. And as we go through here, we'll talk about it and you'll say, oh, that's the Springfield Presbytery. Or, oh, I recognize that. That's the Washington Association or the Christian Association of Washington. So, yeah, these are ideas that have been important in the Restoration Movement. I think I could argue that they've been important from the very beginning of time, and they will continue to be important, just like Jane said. You know, we don't think about there being prophets in the church, but there are people who perceive that that's the case. And I think there are probably some people that think that we still have apostles. I know that the Mormon Church refers to certain people as apostles. I've never been able to pin them down on exactly what the similarity is, but